Welcome. Today is Thursday, June the 9th. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, four people have been killed in a terror attack in Tel Aviv. A surprising statistic on gun violence and mental health in the United States. Tennis star Maria Sharapova suspended for 2 years for doping. And could Adele's new hit be the song of the summer? We both know we ain't kids no more. Send my love to you, new life. It's all on today's International Edition. Well, the U.S. State Department is condemning in the strongest possible terms what it calls a horrific and cowardly terrorist attack against innocent civilians in Israel. Two Palestinian gunmen opened fire on shoppers and diners Wednesday night at a busy marketplace near the Israeli Defense Ministry in Tel Aviv. International Edition's Jim Stevenson got the latest from video reporter Sivan Raviv in Tel Aviv.
There are four dead and six wounded, one of them in critical condition, as a result of what seems to have been a planned terrorist attack in Tel Aviv in a very busy Sirona compound. That's the name of Tel Aviv. It's a trendy area filled with shops and cafes, which sees a lot of Israeli and tourists. It appears two terrorists made their way to Tel Aviv this evening. They presumably dined at a local restaurant in that compound. And as witnesses report, they suddenly pulled out guns from their backpacks and began shooting. Police later arrived to the area and chased the suspects. There were gunshots. One of the terrorists was shot by Israeli police forces, and by now both have been apprehended and neutralized. From what we hear from witnesses, they say the gunshots went on for a long time, and police initially believed there may be more terrorists on scene, but at the moment it seems they have caught them all.
Sivan, it seems that there was some degree of coordination in this attack.
Well, definitely there were two terrorists that were working together. There were theories that there may be more, but at the moment police say it was just those two. They arrived to Tel Aviv, we're not sure from where yet, and planned out their attack in a sophisticated manner in which they pretended to be dining along with other people at that restaurant, that local restaurant, until they opened fire.
Sirona Market is located very near the Defense Ministry, correct?
That's right. It's right across the street.
And I understand that Mr. Netanyahu has returned from Moscow at this point.
Yes. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu was in Moscow for a visit, and he had just landed in Israel. He's back, and he has convened an emergency session following this attack.
Tell me a little bit about Sirona Market. This is a open-air, vibrant area, usually.
Yes, it's a bustling area, very vibrant, very trendy. It's fairly new, only a few years old. It's opened several years ago, and it sees many tourists that come visit there, and Israelis like to go there and attend events and restaurants, and there are shops. Very pretty, very green, and sees many people every night.
No area is immune to an attack, but Tel Aviv has not seen a whole lot of attacks. And for something, you know, with the use of firearms, this is pretty rare.
Right. As you may know, there have been numerous terrorist attacks on Israel for several months now. It's in what's referred to as the Knives Intifada, or in the Intifada of the Individuals, seen as a large number of terrorists with no specific affiliation in the past several months have attacked Israelis, generally stabbing them using knives. But there have been some use of guns as well. Not much, but there have, and tonight is one of those cases.
From your vantage point, what is the change in security?
Israel is very big on security, as you must assume. And in Tel Aviv in particular, every cafe, every restaurant, every mall has guards checking people coming in and out. There are metal detectors checking for whether it be it knives or guns or anything suspicious, just like you have in airports around the world. I don't think there will be an increase in security because it is already high. Tel Aviv just hosted a large gay parade this past Friday. It was one of the biggest gay pride festivals this country has ever known. About 200,000 people made their way to Tel Aviv to celebrate and partake in the event, many from Europe and even the U.S. So Tel Aviv was very high on security all week long. But you can always breach the security. There's always those moments when a terrorist attack is possible. Now it's just days later since this large festival and the terrorist attack in the heart of the bustling city. They did manage to put it together and execute it.
And you can get updates on the story at voanews.com. Now let's take a look at what is buzzing on social media with International Edition's Michael Lippin. Hi, Michael. I understand actually there is a lot of talk about what happened in Tel Aviv.
One of the top trending topics on Twitter today, with at least 105,000 mentions of the city's name, Tel Aviv, since the incident took place. Now, Twitter users also have been talking about it with the hashtag Tel Aviv Attack. Reaction to the attack has been mixed. The Tel Aviv municipality's Twitter account, at Tel Aviv, posted a photo of City Hall. Now, in that photo, the City Hall was lit up with blue and white lights in the shape of the Israeli flag shortly after the attack happened. The tweet also had this message: sad night, but this city will not stop. Now, the U.S. ambassador to Israel, Dan Shapiro, whose Twitter handle is at AmbShapiro, sent out this response: strongly condemned tonight's horrific terrorist attack in Tel Aviv. Cannot be justified. Deepest condolences to the families of those murdered. But Israel did not get much sympathy from pro-Palestinian human rights activist Mary Hughes Thompson, whose handle is at Maria Palestina. She wrote, "Too bad about Tel Aviv, but Palestinians are killed every day and nothing will change till Israelis feel the heat and say end occupation."
So how are Palestinian leaders reacting on social media?
Islamist militant group Hamas welcomed the attack. The Hamas leader of Gaza, Ismail Haniyeh, is on Twitter with the handle Ismail Haniyeh, and he tweeted a photo purportedly of one of the assailants, praising him as a hero. The secular Fatah party of Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas didn't go quite that far. It used its official Twitter feed to say that Israel is reaping the repercussions of choosing violence against the Palestinian people.
Let's shift gears a little bit. I know there's something else trending on social media that's definitely a little more lighthearted.
An Australian marketing company called GfK, it recently released its findings on what it calls the world's ugliest color. This is a greenish-brown color known as opaque couche or Pantone 448C. Now, this is actually a trending topic on Facebook, where you can find lots of articles on this allegedly ugliest color of the world. The marketing company came up with this specific color, opaque couche, as it was surveying consumers to find out what color would make cigarette packets look the most unappealing. And that, of course, is in a bid to put people off from buying cigarettes in the first place. If you want to see what this color looks like, just get onto Facebook and judge for yourself. Some of the reaction that I saw were from people who are interested in fashion. And it was actually Cosmopolitan magazine published an article saying that this specific color has been used in many types of women's fashion, and actually saying that those dresses that use this color are quite attractive.
All right, I guess I better check it out. Thank you so much, Michael. You can follow him at Michael_Lippin. We also invite you to follow the International Edition stream at VOA_IE. Here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. Internet searches may point to medical problems. The U.S. boasts its military presence in the Mediterranean. The UN backs an accelerated response to ending HIV/AIDS. A lab on wheels is tracking Zika spread in Brazil. And hot, humid, and green at the South Pole. Find expanded coverage of these stories and much more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. VOA's International Edition continues. The race for the U.S. president has entered a new phase following the last of the major primary contests and setting the stage for a general election showdown between the two major party presumptive nominees, Democrat Hillary Clinton and Republican Donald Trump. Now, the race will offer Americans a stark choice in what promises to be one of the nastiest campaigns in U.S. history. VOA national correspondent Jim Malone has a preview from Washington.
for Democrat Hillary Clinton, a history-making moment to savor. Now on track to become the first woman presidential nominee in U.S. history. But Clinton wasted little time in shifting her focus to her expected Republican opponent, Donald Trump.
We believe that we are stronger together. And the stakes in this election are high, and the choice is clear. Donald Trump is temperamentally unfit to be president and commander-in-chief.
Clinton defeated rival Bernie Sanders in 4 of 6 contests Tuesday, including the big prize of California. But for now, Sanders is soldiering on.
The fight in front of us is a very, very steep fight, but we will continue to fight for every vote and every delegate we can get.
We're going to be discussing all of the things that have taken place with the Clintons. I think you're going to find it very informative.
Donald Trump is also eager to take on Clinton, attacking her tenure as Secretary of State and the fundraising efforts of the Clinton Foundation.
Hillary Clinton turned the State Department into her private hedge fund. The Russians, the Saudis, the Chinese all gave money to Bill and Hillary and got favorable treatment in return.
But Trump remains in damage control mode after he accused a federal judge of bias because of his Mexican-American ancestry, a comment that repulsed Republicans like House Speaker Paul Ryan.
Claiming a person can't do the job because of their race is sort of like the textbook definition of a racist comment. I think that should be absolutely disavowed. It's absolutely unacceptable. But do I believe that Hillary Clinton is the answer? No, I do not.
Trump went too far for Illinois Senator Mark Kirk, and he withdrew his endorsement.
Just too racist and bigoted for the party of Lincoln for me.
New Jersey Governor Chris Christie rose to Trump's defense.
I've said this before, that I know Donald Trump. I've known him for 14 years, and Donald Trump is not a racist.
Clinton enters the general election campaign with a slight lead, says analyst Kyle Kundick.
It's kind of a choice between stability in Clinton and radical change in Trump. And voters may be a little bit more, you know, conservative, not in terms of politically conservative, but just in terms of not wanting to take a big risk. And I think that's Clinton's best pitch, is to say that Trump is too risky.
Kundick also predicts a nasty, character-driven campaign that will dominate the race for the next 5 months. Jim Malone, VOA News, Washington.
The vulnerability of citizens in full display today with the shooting at a Tel Aviv market. And here in the United States, the debate on guns continues. It's already been a topic in the presidential campaign as well. The United States is home to roughly 35% to 50% of the world's civilian-owned guns, even though it holds less than 5% of the world's population. Now, gun rights advocates say guns are not the problem. Many have called for greater awareness and action for people with mental illness. But VOA health reporter Carol Pearson tells me that a new study finds a misconception about the link between mental health issues and gun violence.
The average person in this country, in the U.S., believes that the average person with mental illness is dangerous and prone to violence. Studies at Johns Hopkins and elsewhere have proven that this is wrong. And in fact, the latest study shows that depictions of the mass shootings in the media are what's driving this belief. Mass shootings are actually a rare event.
It doesn't seem rare. And really, when you compare it to other nations.
No, but if you don't, what isn't being reported, the United States does have a gun violence problem when you compare it to other countries. But as far as the mental health aspect of it, mental illness plays a very small amount a role in gun violence. According to the Johns Hopkins Center for Gun Policy and Research, and they've been studying gun violence for a long time, the average person in the U.S. believes that the average person with mental illness is dangerous and that could be is more likely to commit a violent crime than a person without mental illness. Studies at Johns Hopkins and elsewhere prove that this is wrong. This is mostly fueled by the media. For example, every time you have a mass shooting, and the mass shootings are very commonly linked to people with mental illnesses, it perpetuates that belief. A new study that came out from Johns Hopkins shows that schizophrenia was the most specific diagnosis that people mentioned as being related to violence. But they also, in their research, found that if schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, and depression were cured, the U.S. problem of violence by guns would be diminished only by about 4%. It's very, very small. However, they say that what perpetuates this are is the coverage that this gets. And it is a dramatic event. You know, you have school children shot. I guess in the Newtown school shooting several years back, there were 31 people killed by Adam Lanza, who had taken guns to this one little school in Connecticut, and he shot 4, 5, and 6-year-olds, along with some teachers.
But a lot of these people have been found to have mental illness, or at least some of them have been found to have mental illness.
Yes, Adam Lanza wasn't diagnosed beforehand, but certainly when you looked at his life, it was very, very odd. But it's still, it gets a lot of media attention. What happens in the U.S. is that there are about 30,000 homicides by guns every year, but most of that is alcohol or drug-related or gang-related. And that's not what gets covered. What gets covered are these spectacular events, like a shooting in a theater in Colorado.
When people look at this country and they say they've got a gun problem and the gun lobbyists say, no, we've got a mental health issue, are you saying that that's been found to not really be the case?
No, there is a mental health issue. In fact, if you look at suicide, suicide accounts for 61% of gun deaths. So most people who have a mental illness are more likely to commit suicide than they are to commit violent crimes. And that is not being treated. There was a Surgeon General under President George W. Bush who did a study and concluded that because there were no mental health facilities of any merit, really, in the United States, that the jails would then be the place where people with mental illness end up. And that happens to be true. About 40% of people in our jails have mental illness. And it depends on whether you want to punish them for breaking laws or treat mental illness before they start breaking laws.
So the bottom line is, according to this Johns Hopkins study, most people with mental illness are not violent.
That's correct. In fact, studies other than Johns Hopkins show that most people with mental illness are more likely to be a victim of crime than they are to commit crimes.
All right. That was VOA health reporter Carol Pearson. Thank you so much, Carol. Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi addressed the U.S. Congress Wednesday, telling leaders that the world's two largest democracies are clearly united.
Let us work together to convert shared ideals into practical cooperation. There can be no doubt that in advancing this relationship, both nations stand to gain.
Modi met with President Obama at the White House yesterday. The visit follows years of being shunned in the U.S. because of religious violence in his home state. Maria Sharapova has been handed a 2-year suspension for failing a drug test of a newly banned substance. Sharapova was provisionally suspended in early March and quickly held a news conference in Los Angeles where she admitted to failing a test for meldonium in January.
I wanted to let you know that a few days ago I received a letter from the ITF that I had failed a drug test at the Australian Open. I did fail the test, and I take full responsibility for it.
The tennis star says she will appeal what she calls an unfairly harsh punishment, saying she wasn't aware that meldonium was a barred substance. She did test positive a day after losing to Serena Williams in the Australian Open quarterfinals. Sharapova, who was 9 years old when her father moved her from Russia to Florida to pursue a tennis career, is one of 10 women in tennis history with a career Grand Slam. You're listening to International Edition. This is VOA.
Jazz America.
This is Russ Davis, and on my program Jazz America, I carry on the tradition begun decades ago by the great Willis Conover by exploring the wonders of a century of jazz history. I'll cover it all from Dixieland to swing to bebop to modal, free jazz, fusion, world jazz, contemporary, and beyond. Plus, you'll hear the words of the artists themselves as they tell their incredible stories. Join me for Jazz America, Saturdays and Sundays at 13 hours Universal Time, online at voanews.com and the Voice of America.
News happens around the clock, and VOA brings you the latest at the top of each hour.
This is Joe Palca.
I'm Victor Beatty.
Francis Alonso.
Tune in for a summary of the news at the top of each hour, around the clock on The Voice of America. Hourly newscasts on the radio and on the internet at voanews.com. VOA, a leader in news coverage for over 70 years.
This is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, singer Adele has a brand new hit on her hands. But first, Oscar-winning British actress Helen Mirren has joined U.S. lawmakers' efforts to return artwork stolen by Nazis during the Holocaust to its rightful owners. Decades after the Nazis looted artwork mostly from Jews, many valuable pieces remain in art galleries and private collections worldwide. Earlier this year, a group of U.S. senators introduced a bill that would ensure U.S. claims to Nazi-confiscated art are quickly resolved. At a Senate hearing this week, Mirren made a heartfelt plea.
It's a terribly sad fact that more than 70 years later, victims of the Holocaust and their families are still contemplating whether to seek restitution for what was stolen from them and lost under the most horrible of circumstances.
Now, legal restrictions have discouraged many rightful owners from seeking their inheritance. One of them, Simon Goodman, testified that he'd been fighting for 20 years for the return of his grandfather's collection.
Fritz Goodman was murdered in Theresienstadt in April 1944. But it was not until 1994, when my father died and I inherited his correspondence, that I became aware of my father's solitary and largely unsuccessful quest to regain his own father's dispersed collection.
One of the most common obstacles has been the lapse of time between the theft and the claim for restitution. Advocates maintain there can be no statute of limitations for crimes perpetrated during the Holocaust. Singer Adele continues to be a musical success, and she is now out with yet another hit song. International Edition's Susan Yackey talked about it with VOA Border Crossing host Larry London.
Her latest album, 25, was named the best-selling album of the year. And she got the Billboard Award for being the top artist of the year, which she promptly dedicated in memory of Prince. But she's out on the road. She's been on her tour for the new album now for this past year. And she's had some interesting stories come out of her tour. Most recently, this past week, she was in Amsterdam. She sang a Spice Girls song. And she found out that Mel B of the Spice Girls was sitting in the audience. So she decided to do something fun, impromptu, sang the Spice Girls song. And Mel B was asked later what she thought. She said she was speechless. She said, Adele is absolutely amazing. By the way, the Spice Girls are celebrating their 20th anniversary this year. But Adele continues to tour and do some other things, like in Italy recently. She saw a fan filming her concert. She stopped the show and said, "I'm here live. You don't need to film me. Enjoy the show." You know, some people hold up their phones video a little bit on their cell phone. This woman had a video camera. She had the whole unit.
I didn't know that was legal.
Well, I guess in Italy it might be, but Adele didn't appreciate it. I know that she forgot the words to one of her songs during a show recently. So she apologized and told the audience, "Oops, I messed that up." So Adele's just having fun. She's a real natural, down-to-earth person. She signed a record contract at Sony, which is more money than any British female act or any female in music history has ever made.
And how much?
$130 million.
Ooh.
That's a big contract. So she went out and celebrated and bought herself a $10 million mansion in Beverly Hills just this last week.
Well, if you have money to burn.
Why not? Burn it. Burn it my way. I'll help her burn it. And, of course, she's, with Simon Konecki, who she's been with, romantically involved with, and they have a child together named Angelo, but she's yet to wed. the two of them are just kind of living together and being happy in love and not making that official wedding commitment just yet. But the new song is off the 25 album. It's, you know, a beautiful song. I love this song. It's a little bit happier, a little more up-tempo than some of the previous ballads that she's released. So it was about time for an up-tempo, happy song.
Well, let's test it.
It's called Send My Love.
This was all you, none of it me. You put your hands on my body and told me. You told me you were ready for the big one, for the big jump. I'd be your last love.
I can see why you like that.
Yes. Well, I like just about anything and everything that Adele does. And she's kind of on a wave right now. She's just riding the wave of popularity.
You've been listening to International Edition. That's going to do it for us today. We'll be back tomorrow, same time, same place. Find us anytime at voanews.com. Follow us on Twitter at @VOA_IE. Thanks so much for joining us. Thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Zubair El-Tayeb. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have yourself a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The Conference of Western Attorneys General recently hosted its Forum on Oral Trials and attracted close to 400 members of the legal profession from San Luis Potosí, Mexico. Among them were personnel from the Attorney General's Office, the Public Defender's Office, law school students and faculty, bar associations, and private attorneys. Senior litigators from the U.S., including District Attorney John Haroldson from Benton County, Oregon, and Anthony DeSilva, Deputy Attorney General, California Department of Justice, made presentations during the event that also featured a mock oral trial. The event, which took place mid-May, is part of the United States government's support for Mexican public sector legal professionals and is funded under the U.S.-Mexico-Merida Initiative. The forum was inaugurated by San Luis Potosí Attorney General Federico Garza Herrera. Speaking immediately after the event, Robert Arce from the U.S. Consulate General Monterrey noted, "Oral trials will boost the efficiency, transparency, and accountability of the justice system. The legal and law enforcement professionals who came to this forum are committed to meeting their responsibilities under the new criminal justice system. The United States government is privileged to support Mexico's historic transition to a new criminal justice system, and we were delighted to welcome senior litigators from the United States to share their knowledge and experiences with the audience here today. The United States government supports the consolidation of the accusatory system in Mexico through capacity-building programs for federal and state judges, prosecutors, defense attorneys, criminal investigators, forensic experts, and other members of the judiciary, as well as for university law students and professors. Since 2008, under the Merida Initiative, the Conference of Western Attorneys General trained over 25,000 members of the legal and law enforcement communities in Mexico through study tours in countries operating under an accusatory system, seminars, and forums. The U.S. Justice Department has trained over 15,000 justice sector operators in the fundamentals of the accusatorial system. Through other programs funded under the Merida Initiative, the United States government is supporting the training of 1,600 police officers as first responder instructors, helping to equip courtrooms for oral trials and assisting forensic labs to achieve international accreditation. The United States is proud to work with Mexico to support a justice system that serves the needs and protects the rights of the Mexican people.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
for, what's